you're Frankenstein's monster if the monster was made entirely of dead dicks.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
Rio de Janeiro. The beach. The nightlife. The romance. But 15 miles from paradise is a place called the City of God.
Everybody, this is Wreckatopia, episode 12. I hope everybody's hearing us fine out there. Wreckatopia, episode 12. I'm Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott.
And today's big recommend is going to be City of God. Mm-hmm. Before we get to that, acknowledging our patrons who are currently watching us live on this show.
We'll do it live.
And somebody, Nick Jagged's like, sudden A-team. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. It was very sudden. It was sudden for us, too.
One button. It just says go live. There's no button to go live with a countdown. I think Dicer just has like a magic producer's button that doesn't show up for me.
But he's got anyway. The magic stick. Before we get into City of God, we've got some small recommends to unleash on the public.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Who wants to start us off?
I'll start it off. I've got two movies I want to recommend in the small recommends category.
Okay.
Real quick before that, I want to shout out this new Coke flavor, Starlight, which is supposed to taste like space.
Ooh.
I love this new Cola War experimental flavor game that's going on just because some of them really hit. I don't know what space tastes like. I don't even know what this tastes like. Mm-hmm. It tastes like Coke, but different, and I really, really like it, and my wife and I can't stop buying it. Okay, two movies that are not well rated by critics or Rotten Tomatoes, but that I think were rawly judged when they came out and are just good and fine movies.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one I'll start off with is one called The Last Holiday. Is Queen Latifah.
Yeah.
Is told she has a brain disease and she's going to die soon. And she's been saving for this dream wedding and honeymoon at this place in, Czech Republic. It's somewhere in Eastern Europe. It's this fancy-ass hotel resort that super ritzy people go to that has a famous chef.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when she finds out she's got this disease, she quits her job and decides to just go on this trip. Well, I'm going to spend all my nest egg and just live it up.
Mm-hmm.
She's been in love with LL Cool J, one of the guys at her job. But she doesn't tell him anything before she leaves. And they've never actually dated or anything. And she gets over there. Tim Matheson's there. Tim Matheson? Not Tim Matheson. Oh, shit.
That would be a... it makes me feel like Tim Matheson's correct. Because how would you just randomly come up with Tim Matheson?
Because it's a Tim. Oh, I think I got the wrong Tim. Give me the cast. Timothy Hutton.
Timothy Hutton. Okay. All right.
He's like a big Walmart owner, Jeff Bezos kind of guy. Alicia Witt is his assistant who's sleeping with him.
Mm-hmm.
Giancarlo Esposito is there as a senator. Gerard Depardieu, who's not necessarily a good topic these days. He plays the chef. And basically, over the course of this week-long vacation, she just charms the shit out of everyone except Timothy Hutton, who's convinced she's a plant from his competitor who's trying to fuck with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just charming. It's not... There's a reason it's a 50-something, 60-something on Rotten Tomatoes. It's not great. It's not breaking any new ground. It's just... If you want to spend an hour and a half with charming actors in a charming scenario, when I flip by it, I almost always stop for a few minutes. It's just really, really fun. I don't think Queen Latifah's ever been more fun, at least for me.
Mm-hmm.
She does a lot of like badass roles like Equalizer and Set It Off.
Yeah.
But she's really, really charming in this. And so there you go. Not great. 6.5 on IMDb. That's actually not too bad on IMDb.
Yeah.
But there you go. That's my first small recommend.
I can't even remember if I've seen this movie. I know that it came out when I was at Hollywood. This didn't happen to come out in 2005, did it?
This came out in 2006, which 2006. That's IMDb, so it may have been 2005.
My guess is that's probably right. 2006 is like the actual release year, and it was not some like festival.
It's a remake of a 1950 film. I didn't know that.
Yeah. But I think I may have seen this, but it's one of those that has long left my memory at this point.
Yeah.
I watched one of the early Matthew Vaughn movies, Layer Cake.
Ooh.
Hadn't seen it in forever. It was almost like watching it for the first time, you know, because it's just one of those that I'd seen it when it was in theaters, and then 18 years later, I still hadn't seen it a second time, so popped it in. And this is Daniel Craig as, you know, before his Bond popularity. And this is probably my first introduction to Daniel Craig.
Mm-hmm.
I had probably seen him in Road to Perdition before this. But I don't think that registered at the time Layer Cake came out that was the same. That was the dude in Road to Perdition. I think Road to Perdition was still not like, high up on my list is like, I need to watch that again. And now Road to Perdition is one of those movies where I know, mm-hmm. like, you know, Daniel Craig is a drug dealer. This is kind of, this is in the same vein as Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Matthew Vaughn, I believe, was producer of that movie and Snatch. So he was a producer of these Guy Ritchie movies. Now he's directing his own, kind of thing where it's gangsters, and there are so many characters to keep track of and so many different plots and so many different motives that are going on in it. And so like, he's a drug dealer who is told by his boss that a guy he knows he's lost track of his daughter, and he needs to find his daughter. And he also wants him to team up with this other drug dealer to sell like a million of these pills of some sort. And, he starts doing this, but of course, like, things start going wrong because, you know, this is one of those movies that sets up the rules at the beginning of it where like, if you're going to be a good, whatever you are at what in this kind of business, you have to follow these rules. And of course, everything about this new job breaks every rule that he's possibly ever set up for himself. And it's just one of those type of things. What happens when you break your own rules? Well, you know, your life starts going to shit is what happens. And like, it's one of these just movies where it's like, this person wants this, and this person wants that, and this person is lying about what he wants, and this person is, you know, it's like, and there's so many things that every action has a consequence to it. And that's one of the things that's fun about these types of movies, is that just everything has this interconnectivity to it. That, you know, if you try to do one thing, then somebody else is going to get pissed off. If you try to make them happy, somebody else is going to get pissed off. So you really have no actually, you know, any way out of this situation whatsoever. Shout out to Michael Gambon, who is such a fucking badass in this movie. Oh my God. I want to be Michael Gambon so much. He's a crusty fucker in this movie, but my God, he just want to be Michael Gambon. You just want to be that guy. He's so cool. Layer Cake is a lot of fun. Matthew Vaughn is of course best known for Kingsman these days, but you see a lot of people in here that were just beginning, like Sienna Miller is in this. Tom Hardy is in this. You have a Colm Meaney. Just a ton of people are in this movie. Layer Cake's a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. It's crazy how unique his style is very much similar to Guy Ritchie's, but it's still so unique.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as you watch both men's careers evolve. I haven't seen Layer Cake in years, but I remember really, really liking it. Once I saw Lock, Stock, I just went on a binge of all of those movies I could find.
Yeah.
My second small recommend, mm-hmm. is another movie that Rotten Tomatoes has given a 52.
Oh, but damn.
IMDb gives it 7.3.
Whoa, that's weird. You don't usually have that kind of disparity.
You really don't. And that's, I think this may not be for everybody, but this is a 2013 movie by Ben Stiller called The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Yeah, yeah. I can see why. I've seen this, and this is one of the, yeah, I know exactly where, why this has got that split.
Yeah, it's not for everybody, but this is a mood movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's not dissimilar to Garden State, which is also fairly divisive.
Mm-hmm.
People think it's too precious. Other people think it's poignant.
Yeah.
Very good music choice. It's the 2013-iest music movie you've ever seen in your life. Just watch the movie or look up the soundtrack and you'll be like, oh, I feel exactly the way this movie wants
mm-hmm.
me to
feel. Yeah.
Long shots of him doing long board skateboarding down Icelandic roads with great soundtrack music. The story is pretty simple. This is another remake, but it's updated. Life magazine is going all digital. In the process, laying a bunch of people off. Ben Stiller's job is the guy who picks the cover photos, I think, or the guy who processes the cover photos. And Sean Penn is this world-renowned photographer who's always like hanging upside down from a mountain cliff to shoot a goat or whatever.
Yeah.
Ben Stiller loses a negative and doesn't know which photo the photographer said this has to be the cover of the last print edition. So he goes around the world to find this guy and find out what the image is supposed to be. He's also in love with Kristen Wiig. I'm not sure that romance subplot needs to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just really charmed by this movie, and I realize that not everyone will be. I say give it 15 minutes, and
yeah.
If you're not digging it, then maybe go away. But if you're kind of feeling it, it might suck you in from that point on.
Yeah. I think, if I'm not mistaken, a long time ago, before this movie was made, Jim Carrey was supposed to be in this movie.
I believe so, yes.
This was one of those where it's like you could see it in, like, this is coming out in, you know, June of 2004 or whatever it was when they were thinking about it, and it just never materialized. And then finally Ben Stiller's like, okay, I guess I got to do it myself. But yeah, I enjoyed this. I haven't seen it since I bought it on Blu-ray, however many years ago. But I remember going, this isn't bad. I remember it was like, it was that kind of movie where it's like, it's not very good, or it has a lot of promise and it just doesn't fulfill it or whatever. But
yeah,
I really liked it.
Yeah. And like Nick says here in the chat, this has a bad score because it was marketed as a new Ben Stiller comedy.
Yeah.
Which is a good point, because I do kind of feel like, I'm going to look it up after the show, I do kind of feel like the trailers were edging a little more towards comedy, and it's not all about comedy. It's much more subdued than that. There mm-hmm. are laughs, but it's more about chuckles than it is like guffaws.
And, right.
Anyways, it may have been a marketing issue, and then people found it, and that's why it has a better IMDb score. But there you mm-hmm. go.
Yep. The next one is as small a recommend as I can possibly give, and that doesn't mean that, you know, anything one way or another. It's just that there's only been two episodes, and I'm not saying that what I've seen is just pure greatness or anything like that, but it's intriguing, and I can at least say that, you know, it's gotten my attention enough that I'm going to watch the next episodes when they come out. It's on Amazon Prime. It's called Outer Range.
Ooh.
It's got Josh Brolin in it.
Ooh, I saw the trailer for this.
Yeah, and it's got Lewis Pullman, who it took me a second because if you're familiar with Lewis Pullman from Bad Times at El Royale, mm-hmm. and you know that he's got this kind of like childlike quality to him and everything in that movie, it's going to throw you a little bit when you see him as a more fully fledged adult in this one, with a different kind of an accent and everything. But I saw him and I was like, I've seen this guy before. Kind of looks like Bill Pullman. Oh, I bet it's his son. But he's in it. Lily Taylor's in it. Imogene Poots is in it. He runs this huge ranch, and basic conflict that comes up is that there's a rival family who has somehow successfully gone to the property assessor and is going to basically take a whole mile of their land because of such and such gobbledygook real estate. Whatever. Will Patton plays the head of that family.
Nice.
Will Patton, always solid, always great.
Solid.
And so that's the main conflict. But there's something weird going on around this this patch of land. There is a huge hole with a void in it. Mm. This is a science fiction-y kind of aspect to the show that is making you go, what the fuck? And so Josh Brolin is the only person in his family that knows about this giant hole that's in the middle of like this land that's going to eventually not be his, apparently. and so he studies it, he throws stuff down it, nothing returns, obviously. And the only other little aspect is that Imogene Poots is a mysterious stranger who comes along and says, "Hey, I'm just hanging out. I want to I'll pay you to stay on your land for a while or whatever." But apparently she's got way more going on, of course, because this is a TV show and she's much too big of an actress to just put in for a day or whatever. So she's got some other things to do in this show. But one of the main conflicts right off the bat is that and this is so predictable, there's two brothers, Lewis Pullman and this other guy, I can remember his name, are like, let's go out to the bar. And you're like, oh, I guarantee you they go to the bar and they run into this other family at the bar. That's the way these shows always are. They go to the bar, they drink, and they're going to run into these other brothers, and there's going to be testosterone flying and blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, that's what happens. It's a fight over a girl, and they get into a fight, and eventually it goes too far. It's one of those fights that happens where nobody is watching at all and ends up in somebody dying. And by the end of it, this body is getting thrown into the void at the end of the first episode. And then something else, there's even more that happens right after that. And so you're like, what the fuck? And then the second episode, you're like, wait a minute. If this happened, what happened? You know, if this happened, what happened? That's basically what you're going through at this time. And by the end of the second episode, it has gone even further where you're like, oh my God, what the hell is going on? A lot of sci-fi elements, but it's kind of in the background. And mainly a story, a good old fashioned Western story about land and shit. After that, it's a small recommend because I've only seen two episodes. Like I said, they're not blowing me away or anything yet. I'm just saying, I was interested enough to see this. I saw Josh Brolin on Colbert, and they showed one clip from it where he's doing a blessing, and he's basically yelling at God the whole time in the blessing. And I was like, Josh Brolin, that guy, he's a good actor. He may amount to something someday.
Yeah, if he keeps at it.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm liking it. So,
yeah, that's when I saw the trailer, I thought instantly, Cowboys and X-Files.
Mm-hmm. Cowboys and X-Files.
It does, you know, a little bit of that. It's on my list to watch, so I'm glad to see that so far you've been interested in what they've been showing you. All right.
Yeah.
I guess it's now time for the big recommend.
The big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
This is a movie that I have been praising for many, many years now. City of God. I don't know if I told it on here, but just the brief story is that we're a theater, Hollywood 27. We did not get very many critical screenings of anything. We just so happened to get the critic screening of City of God. Person who worked at the theater and a buddy of his, they had heard of this movie. It wasn't on the pulse of what was getting made and what was coming out and all that. It's probably surprise. It might be surprising to a lot of you to realize I don't really keep up with what's getting filmed and what is coming out. I'm more about like after I watch it, that's when I start to get to know things about the movie and everything. So I didn't know anything about City of God going in. But I heard that, heard from them, hey, this might be really good. So we saw this movie one morning, at Hollywood 27, and it took forever for this to like actually come out and be a big release. I think we saw it early in the year, 2003. And then it came out much later for a full blown release later in 2003. Sort of got swept up in a lot of that, if Return of the King did not come out the same year, this would have probably gotten a lot more Oscar nominations, and it may have gotten some wins even and everything. Fernando Moraes got Best Director nomination, but the movie itself did not get Best Picture nomination. So anyway, City of God is one of these movies that when it first starts, you're like, oh shit, what did I just get into? Because it starts off with like this flash cutting of like a knife getting sharpened and a bunch of people running after a chicken. And it's like a bunch of just big, like a lot of cuts and a lot of camera movement and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh no, what is this? What is this movie? But then it slows down and it starts telling this story, and it goes back to basically what is the beginning of the criminal culture in this small part of Rio de Janeiro, it's a slum area just called City of God. Now I haven't read up enough on the actual place to know where exactly this is in Rio, but it's sort of the contrast to what you see on postcards, right? Rio de Janeiro likes to advertise itself as this big, huge tourist attraction. But there's this real ugly side that's on the, you know, that's that they sweep under the rug, so to speak. And he starts talking about these three guys who do smaller crimes, and it's no big deal, but they sort of in their way create one of the biggest gangsters ever. The guy that is named Lil Dice in this, and then later to become Lil Zay. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who's obviously brutal from the beginning. This kid is a bloodthirsty bastard, mm-hmm. right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And when these three guys just do a simple robbery at a motel where people are banging hookers and stuff like that, they're like, let this do this, just steal the money and just go. And then, but he wants to kill people. Yeah. And it's a horrifying, it's maybe one of the most horrifying things ever that you see in this movie, because you see them dead afterwards and there's no real explanation. But then that shows what happens later when it shows him go in after they've already robbed the money and goes in, yeah. and just shoots people and laughs and just enjoying it. And it's like a biggest horror movie you'll ever see. Watching this little kid with the bloodlust that he has. And they underestimate him so much that it's at a point where the guy just like steals Lil Dice's money. Like he's nothing and didn't even realize that guy is a bloodthirsty guy. He's going to kill you. Yeah. And it shows him and his friend, oh gosh, what is it, Benny? But it's Lil Dice and Benny, and they're sort of, it shows them as you know, youngsters growing up and getting to the point of being like, because they're so ruthless, they take over all these other weak drug dealers that are in the town, and basically, like, they have the whole map except for this one area, because Benny is friends with this guy Carrot, mm-hmm. who runs this one section, and they run it in peace for a while, for a really long time. In mm-hmm. fact, it's organized. It's very organized for a long time until Lil Zay becomes a little bit too emotional about what happens with everything, and it starts to go downhill from there. But it's a fascinating. This movie's fascinating. That's just a small part of this movie. it's a fascinating narrative that's kind of like how Pulp Fiction may run it, or like a Goodfellas, or Godfather. There are a ton of like type of influences it looks like this movie has, going back into the past, telling you how everything started, showing you a side character who won't be important now but will be later. They do that a bunch.
And they say, I wrote it down, but it is not time for his story yet. Like, yeah, they do that a bunch in this movie where they're like, freeze the thing and go, well, this is this guy, but we're not ready to tell you about him yet.
And yeah.
Continues on the action.
Yeah.
It's almost like The Prestige and how it's pieced together, jumping back and forth as it does, reinforming what you think you know about certain characters and certain scenes. And, you know, I think narratively the first 15 minutes are probably hard for a lot of people because it does start with that jump cutty chicken chase thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes, wait, we got to go back before we can tell this story. And it mm-hmm. cuts back to City of God and says, here's me. But before we tell my story,
yeah,
we have to tell the story of the Tender Three. And then we go in and we introduce the Tender Three and we follow them for 10. And it could be a little overwhelming just in terms of number of plot lines and characters. But once you just kind of, it's almost like the way I felt the first few episodes of the first season of The Wire.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know who anyone is. But once you kind of settle into the flow of this thing, you figure out who's who and how they're important to the story. This movie has sex, man. I remembered... the characters and the main plot lines. I did not remember how much fucking sex was in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. Everybody. Now, it makes sense. They're human beings. I think this is ultimately a portrait of humanity in a way that you've probably never seen if you've had electricity and a roof over your head for most mm-hmm. of your life. I forgot exactly how much emphasis there was on sex, but also Rocket's continual missing out on his losing his virginity.
Yep.
There's this one scene where he's narrating about buying drugs from Carrot instead of Lil Z and says, yeah, I only smoke with Angelica. And then we see him just having scored weed. He's about to go run off back to Angelica and he runs into this little alley. And before he does, he jumps up into the air to kick his heels and the frames stop for like 4 or 5 frames. Just to give you that blink little moment, it's the most adorable fucking thing.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But there's one point where he's got a girl's phone number on a piece of paper, but it's the only paper they have to smoke some weed.
Yep.
So he's like, I lost count of how many times I missed a chance to lose my virginity.
That's just a small moment in this movie. There's a sequence where Rocket says, basically tells a story of how close he was to becoming a gangster himself.
Yeah.
Where first he's on the bus and they're thinking about stealing the money on the bus because Knockout Ned, who becomes important later in the movie, is counting the money like just in front of everybody. It's like a huge wad of bills and everything. And they end up not robbing him because, quote, he's such a cool guy. And then they get off of the bus and they're going to rob this like ice cream parlor or something like that. And he ends up getting like talking to the girl behind the counter and saying, couldn't rob her. She was so cool.
Yeah.
And couldn't do that. And so then they go, they get picked up hitchhiking, going to another town. And they were going to rob that guy, but he ended up being really cool. And it's really kind of a statement on what you have to be a gangster. Mm-hmm. You don't find the coolness in people. You just want the stuff that you want and don't worry about, you know, you don't get involved in their lives or talk to them or anything like that. So it just goes to show. But that scene where they're like smoking weed and he's burning that right after they didn't rob this girl in the counter and she gave him his number and everything. Now he's burning her number in a joint. It's just fantastic.
It's what you do.
Yeah. But Rocket eventually becomes a photographer, and I love the sort of the story of how he gets the camera too, because mm-hmm. At first he's going to be straight up given the camera. Benny gets the camera in like a drug deal because the one guy who's like he's the guy who's dating Angelica at first, and then he becomes a big junkie, and then he like trades in his father's camera to get some more drugs,
right?
And then it ends up being in the possession of Lil Zay, and then Benny wants to give the camera to Rocket, but then Zay comes in and takes it from him, and then Zay, like, once the war starts happening towards the end and he needs the publicity to show that he's the one that's in charge and all that, he gives the camera to Rocket finally, and Rocket takes his picture, and it accidentally gets printed in the paper,
yeah,
which he thinks is gonna end up killing him. There's so many things about this movie. Like, we've gone over a whole ton of part of the plot, but there's still like so much more. Mm-hmm. So much more, and they pack it in. This movie is not long by any stretch. Mm-hmm. And it's got just it packs so much in. I never seen anything like this.
The duality, I guess, between Lil Zay and Benny, like, because Benny's the coolest hood mm-hmm. in the City of God. Everybody loves him. He's charming. And I think that's what makes Lil Zay snap, right? At that party, yeah. He's just not willing to see Benny be happy
mm-hmm.
and leave. But it's not enough for him to be a deadly gangster. He wants everybody to be on his page as a deadly gangster.
Mm-hmm.
He, I think, directly, mostly inadvertently, ends up getting Benny shot. But, you know, they're like two sides of the same coin, right? They both start out as kind of hoods, but Lil Dice is always a little bit bloodthirsty, and Benny is always just a little bit of a charming kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that whole bit with the guy where Lil Zay, was it Knockout Ned? That Lil Zay basically, he rapes his girlfriend. And
yeah.
Then,
because there's a point, too. That's the other thing, is that Benny says, you really need a girlfriend. But the problem is, he was told by that, like, voodoo guy to never have sex while he had the like this necklace on, or else he would mm-hmm. lose all of his powers. So you get that sense that he's completely cut that out of his life. And it also, I guess, sort of suggests, hey, you need to be open to that in your life some more, because you might calm down a little bit more. It's that, and then there's the whole thing where Knockout Nat is so handsome and he is so ugly, and so it spurs him to do that. Yeah, he rapes Knockout Ned's girlfriend in that.
And then when they're leaving, it goes back to Ned, and he's sitting in his apartment and he's despondent. And then at one point he goes, "Why didn't he kill me?"
Mm-hmm.
And then it cuts back to Lil Zay walking, and he goes, "Why didn't I kill that motherfucker?"
Yeah,
let's go back.
Yeah,
and then they go back.
Yeah.
There's so much humor right alongside tragedy in this mm-hmm. movie. It happens all throughout the film, where you're almost at times feeling guilty for laughing. That's why I say it's a film about humanity. Is that mm-hmm. you know, it's there's that stuff in real life all commingles and happens together, tragedy and victory. And Knockout Ned then joins up with Carrot. And it just basically builds to this years-long turf war that, you know, ends in bloodshed. There's this thing in the movie that they say at least twice, I think, maybe only once, where they talk about how if you run away, they catch you. But if you mm-hmm. stay, they eat you.
Yeah.
And that sort of life in this City of God, that's why that opening scene is so perfect, which they come back to in the end, where he's the photographer and he's caught in between the gangsters and the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I'm going to get killed by both of these people. Like, I'm stuck in the middle. If I run away, they're going to shoot me and think I have, you know, I'm something against them. If I stay right here, I'm going to get caught in the crossfire. It's a literal example of that saying.
Yeah.
This is such a great film.
Yeah. It's so good. I don't even know. I can't come up with anything that is bad about this. There's like not, I don't think there's even any negative in this movie. Fernando Moraes wanted to have amateur actors in this, people who are actually from the City of God who are in this. The guy who plays Lil Zay apparently wasn't even didn't want to be an actor, but he just came along with his buddy at an audition and ended up being in the movie.
Yeah,
as one of the biggest characters in the movie. Shooting this movie was fairly dangerous on its own because he shot in actual favelas and everything. Moraes has not made a movie like this since the Constant Gardener is what came out after this is what I believe he made. And that movie's got its followers, but like it just, he hasn't, I don't think he's made anything nearly as dynamic as this since. So it's kind of a one of a kind type of thing. I'm sure he's made something great that I've just completely whiffed on or whatever, but this movie just so solid in every aspect and just engaging. And the runts in this movie, by the way, that shows the other like really, really dark side of all this is how, you know, little kids get into this. And there's even a kid in there, not a part of that runt family, but like says something like somebody's like, "You're a boy," or whatever. It's like, "I'm not a boy. I'm a man. I've killed. I've done all these different things." And you're like sitting like, this kid's like 11 years old.
Yeah.
But those runts at the very end of this movie are kind of like walking around at the end, kind of talking about what they want to do and all that. And apparently they became one of the biggest notorious gangs in all of Rio at that point. That was the beginning of their story. The movie ends there. But what a fascinating thing. This is this is something that actually happened. You have you have news footage, you have actual photographs of it, and it was and it's told in such a beautiful way. So,
All right. Well, I'm excited for this part. It's the super secret double feature.
Okay.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I am going to walk you through my thought process.
Okay.
As I like to do, because half the fun of this podcast and watching these movies is going, what would I double feature this one?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that pops in your mind is Goodfellas. I think you mentioned that earlier. Yep. There's some structural similarity. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels actually popped into my mind because there's some comedic crime misadventures. If I were able to cheat, and I'm not going to do this, if I were able to cheat, I would double feature the entire fourth season of The Wire.
Ah.
Because it very similarly shows a group of four kids who are really stuck in this poverty, crime, drug dealing situation, and most of them don't get out of it by the end of the season.
Oh, yeah.
So very similar in that theme of which somebody quoted better than me, Slab, thank you. If you run, the beast catches. If you stay, the beast eats.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar in theme there. I thought Boys in the Hood also would match that theme.
Definitely thought of that.
If you heard me a few minutes ago talking about the humanity and the tragedies living right alongside the victories in life, then you might know my double feature is going to be Roma, which is a movie that speaks to me, to very similar themes, that one person is having a victory right next door. Somebody might be having a tragedy. That is life. What is around the corner, you don't know. Your highs may not last very long. Nope. Your lows may not last very long. But about humanity, a picture of humanity that I had never seen before in another culture, I think these two would pair really well. It would be a pretty heady double feature.
Yeah.
Thematically, I think it would really line up well. So there's my super secret.
I think you're right. I think it would line up well. I mean, one movie is not nearly as violent as the other. Has a lot more roughness to it, but I think you're right. There's a lot of some of the same themes in it, for sure. So
all right. Next week's homework.
Yes.
All right, everybody. We're gonna go back to a film you might have heard us talk before in a previous podcast. We're going with 2013's Lock, starring Tom Hardy.
Yep.
And this is a short and sweet film. Let's see. I believe it's only about Of course, right now I can't find anything.
I think it's like less than 90 minutes even.
I think it is. You can find this all kinds of places. You can find it on Showtime. You can find it on Amazon Prime with a premium subscription. You can find it on Hulu with the premium subscription. You can pay as little as $2.99 to rent it from Google or Vudu. It's on Sling and Fubo TV for premium subscriptions, as well as the Roku channel for the premium subscription.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Locke 2013. Lots of places to find it. It is an hour and 25 minutes. It is about a guy driving and making phone calls, and it is riveting, and I can't wait to watch it again. I haven't seen it in probably 5-6 years, and it's got a lot of meat on that bone.
Yeah, and you got basically voice work from Tom Holland in this, Olivia Coleman.
Yep.
Andrew Scott.
It's one of those
fun things to listen to who's on the phone when he's talking as well.
Yeah.
Locke is fantastic. I can't wait to revisit that.
All right.
Questions?
Let's get into some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Any questions? All right. First one up. What was your best recommendation to someone else? By which I mean it got the person to return to you with a holy fucking shitballs. Oh, holy fucking shirtballs. I loved it. That person is a fan of The Good Place.
Yes.
What do you think, Chris?
I don't think I've ever gotten that kind of... well, maybe I have, but I don't remember all of them. But my favorite one is Hell or High Water to you because I believe when we did our best of 2016, I mentioned it as my favorite of that year, and you had not seen it yet. And then I don't know how long it took you to watch it, but then you were like, you know, over the moon about it and had seen it 17 times. Mm-hmm. So I always consider those personal victories whenever I recommend anything to anybody, and then they come back and they know more about the movie than I do. So,
yeah.
That's always, that's probably my favorite one.
Yeah. Locke, which we're doing next week. Was one for you that got a pretty good reaction. The most recent example was with my brother and Being the Ricardos, which you may remember from a couple episodes back, I loved a lot more than most people did. And I don't even have a great history recommending films to my brother.
Mm-hmm.
For like Lord of the Rings, he doesn't like them that much. Like, Arrival, I think it was. Maybe not Arrival. Another movie that he saw that I recommended, and he was like, yeah. So I just had a feeling. There was something in me that said, like, he's going to dig this movie. So when they were here, I don't know, a couple months ago, I showed it to him and his wife and kids and my wife, and everyone loved it. And he was still talking about it the next morning. And I felt, you're right, there's a very big sense of pride to know that you recommended something and they not only liked it, but they liked it so much they consumed it and they want to keep talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, good question. Let's do another one. What are movies? I think we've answered this in some form previously, but
we have.
Always fun. What are movies that are objectively bad that you like?
Yeah, my go-to on this question has always been like something like Ocean's 12, but I'll come up with another one. Billy Madison, I would say, is objectively bad. I don't know. Is there a phenomenon, and I don't think it's just pure nostalgia, but I was probably the right age to enjoy Billy Madison. I was 18 years old when Billy Madison came out. It used to be one of my go on break movies that I would go and watch, just like Happy Gilmore later, was one of those type of things. But Billy Madison, I think, is probably objectively bad because everything about it is so ridiculously unbelievable in it. I mean, it's what sort of generates the humor a lot because it's just wacky. It's just a wacky Adam Sandler movie. But the fact is that his dad is about to give the company to Bradley Whitford, But he wants to prove himself, so he has to go through all the grades of school and graduate in like 2 weeks or some shit. And so like each class he takes, each grade, he's like in and out in like 2 or 3 days or something like that. And then like the most unbelievable of all is like he like is the Veronica Vaughn love interest somehow falls in love with him, even though yes. she obviously doesn't want anything to do with him. And then when he does something where he like pretends to trip and touch her boob on the bus, that's when she starts talking to him. I was like, oh my God, man, is this for real? But the movie's got so many wacky, hilarious moments in it. That are just, you just never get to see this Adam Sandler ever again. How he was in his early 20s when he made this movie. It's just absolutely off the wall, this movie. Just so many ridiculous things are in it. That whole musical number, like that, I'll find myself singing that song every once in a while, just be in the kitchen and all of a sudden, do you have any more gum, more gum, more gum? So Billy Madison will fit that nicely.
I long for Adam Sandler to go back to this kind of, he can't, he's too mature now,
but
this absolutely no holds barred. This and Happy Gilmore are both the same way. Like they had an idea, they did it.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how crazy it was. I like that. I have a couple new answers to this question. One is Venom 2.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is Let There Be Carnage, I believe, technically.
Right.
Objectively, I can't say it's good. I can't.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked it even more than the first one.
I just
started laughing immediately and just dove right in. Another one which might surprise you. You know I love a good high concept, bad sci-fi movie, especially mm-hmm. if it's inspired by Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
As is 2007's Next, starring Nick Cage, Jessica Biel, Julianne Moore, where a man
I remember seeing this movie. Holy shit, this is a terrible movie.
Yeah,
it's fantastic that you love it.
It's so good. It's so bad. It's good. Like, he can see 10, 15 minutes into the future, something like this. The very, very near future. What would seem to be, in my opinion, a fairly useless gift. Unless you're in a very dangerous line of work, right? If like mm-hmm. you might have people who might want to assassinate you, this would be a very helpful power because you find out, right? But on a day-to-day basis, I'm not sure this is going to help me all that much. It's kind of like the Omega 13 mm-hmm. in Galaxy Quest, where it gives you 13 seconds of a jump back in time,
mm-hmm.
which is enough to trip over your toe. Listen, the acting is not great. The only thing here is the concept. And I like the concept enough that I have watched this movie probably 3 or 4 times. And it's bad. It's bad. But it's on Hulu.
You bring up a movie like Next, and I am taken to some weird nebulous part of the past where I'm in a theater on a Thursday night watching this movie before it comes out. And I'm just like, I remember a couple of parts of that movie. And I remember hating it, and then I put it out of my mind. And now 14, 15 years later, you're like, I fucking love Next. And I'm like, oh, shit. God, I haven't seen that. I haven't even heard of that movie for like since I last watched it. So it's kind of amazing that you're bringing that up right now.
Oh, my God. It's so, so bad. So bad. Mm-hmm. All right. What are the movie twists that caught you off guard the most?
I'm going to give you some pretty straightforward ones here. The verbal Kent is Kaiser Soze thing in The Usual Suspects definitely threw me for a loop, especially since I remember watching the movie for the first time where Agent Kuyan says, Dean Keaton is Kaiser Soze. And you're like, oh shit, that's fucking mind blowing. Cause you're sitting there going, yeah, it totally makes sense. I remember getting chills on my arm, the very idea that Keaton might be Kaiser Soze. And then they do the verbal Kent second twist. Oh no, are we frozen again?
You do for 2 seconds, you're back.
The verbal Kent second twist is after that, and you're like, yeah. Holy shit, this brings things into another incredible light that I did not realize. So yeah, that one threw me for a loop. And then in sort of the same vein, same year, another Kevin Spacey movie, but Gwyneth Paltrow's Head in a Box in Seven.
Oh, Jesus.
Because you're sitting there, they're going out to the desert, and they're going to see the two bodies, and they're like, okay, well, where are you taking me to? And you're like, oh, there's this sense of dread. What the hell? Why is he taking them to the two bodies? Is he talking about them, the detectives? They're dead. They're going to be dead somehow in this scenario. And then the delivery truck shows up, and Morgan Freeman goes to retrieve it, and he opens the box, and he's like, oh, shit. You know, it's like John Doe's got the upper hand. And that is where it's like, oh, fuck. And then, yeah, they have that one brief flash of Gwyneth Paltrow's head before Brad Pitt blows Kevin Spacey away. But that one threw me for a loop for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, so the first one I'm going to give is Arrival.
Mm-hmm.
I watched that with you.
Yeah.
And I remember walking almost to the exit door. I said to you, so is that girl from the beginning the kid they decide to have at the end? And you go, yeah. And I go, fuck.
Yeah.
Because I was pretty sure that's what that was. But man, I just did not see that coming.
Mm.
And then the other one is Frailty.
Oh, yeah.
Which I don't really want to spoil, but I will just say feels like one kind of movie for about 90% of it. And then it's actually a different kind of movie once the last 10% is revealed. And I didn't see that coming. There was so much meat in the family trauma flashback stuff that I didn't expect that. All right.
Other suggestions that came out, Knives Out. Yes. Has a really good, twist to it. Fight Club obviously has a great one. Apathy says, I pissed my friends off when I called Usual Suspects early. I wonder when you saw this movie though. Did you see it in 1995 in the movie theater, or did you see it? Cause I feel like now if you were to watch Usual Suspects, like let's say you were born in, I don't know, 1998 or something, and there's been so many movies with so many twists and everything. Do you go into the Usual Suspects looking for that? Because back in 1995, you weren't really looking for that twist or anything, and then it became a part of everything.
Well, man,
but kudos to you for picking it out anyway.
That's a huge part of the deal here too, right? You were spoiled for Sixth Sense more overtly than I was. I had a coworker.
Yeah.
I was on my way. I was in my civvies. I wasn't working. I was on my way back to watch The Sixth Sense opening weekend. And one of my fellow managers says, see if you can guess the twist.
Yeah.
And at that point, I fucking will.
Well, yeah. Now you're just looking for what the twist could possibly be. And guess what? You're gonna figure it out because you're not even expecting it before. Fucking twists.
Yeah, those are some good answers. Ender's Game, that's a good
answer. Yeah, Ender's Game, for sure. And especially when I read the book for the first time, I thought, oh, no, this is, that's devastating.
<It's> awesome.
Yeah.
All right. What is your most memorable movie/TV insult?
Oh, my God. When this, I love this question because this gets me to, it allows me to reiterate an insult that came on Veep, which was filled with insults. But Zach Woods says this, and this is, he's talking about I can't remember the tall gangly guy's name that's in that movie, but they always make fun of him because he's such an asshole and he's, you know, whatever. But Zach Woods says, you're not even a man. You're like an early draft of a man where they just sketched out a giant, mangled skeleton, but they didn't have time to add details like pigment or self-respect. You're Frankenstein's monster. If the monster was made entirely of dead dicks. That's just one of those just, you know, that is just one of the most beautiful insults I have ever seen on a TV or a movie.
Oh man. I wish I'd thought longer and harder and found some more funny stuff. The first thing that came to mind was West Wing. There's a episode in the first three or four seasons where Martin Sheen's President Bartlett is in that famous Washington Cathedral where all the funerals happen for government people.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends up alone and he lights up a cigarette and he starts talking to God. And at the very end of it, he calls God a feckless thug and drops the cigarette and stamps it out with his foot and walks out.
Yeah.
And I was still like a church-going person at this point, but even that me was like, holy shit, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Like you're going to die tomorrow now. I also, you know my love for Liar Liar. My wife,
oh, yes.
This movie daily, mm-hmm. But I love...
Talk about a movie I used to watch on break all the time, Liar yeah. Liar.
There's a scene in the boardroom where he ends up going around the table insulting everyone, and she's egging him on because she knows he has to tell the truth and she's trying to get him in trouble. So she tries to get him to insult the boss, and he basically says he's a pedantic, pontificating, pretentious bastard, a belligerent old fart, a worthless steaming pile of cow dung, figuratively speaking. And it's just one of my very, very favorite insults of all time. Let's see.
Yeah, you're only leading two things right now, Jack and shit, and Jack just left town. Army of Darkness is that one. And then you have most of the insults on MASH. I don't know if you're talking about the TV show or the movie. The movie has quite a few good ones. Swimming with Sharks, you are nothing. If you were in my Jeremy's going to talk about The Harder They Fall? I'll run down Swimming with Sharks. You are nothing. If you were in my toilet, I wouldn't bother flushing it. My bath mat means more to me than you. Patrick gives us the how do you write women so well and as good as it gets. This is one of my favorite. This is in the trailer. He's like, I think of a man and I take away reason and accountability. there's another one that's pretty good on here. How I Met Your Mother. Marshall says he picked out not one, not two, but three sturdy cheese-bearing crackers for his couples night. And Lily says, you're a sturdy cheese-bearing cracker. Anyway, The Harder They Fall?
Yeah, it's one of the best insults of all time. I'm sure that's why Patrick reminded me of it. But it's where the hero shows up to the villain's town, and there's this guy standing there. There's a bunch of guys standing there, henchmen. And he says to one of them, I'd ask you to go find your superior, but that'd be like asking you to go find your daddy. Could be anyone.
Yes.
It's such a great way to say you are not important enough for me to even interact with. I'm going to move on from you. I love that movie, but that one line stood out the most to me.
And Catherine also throws in Twat Waffle from Coda, which I also enjoy too. There's some, what is it? It's the W's, I think, in that.
It's the double W's.
Yeah, it's really goes well together.
Final question. In an alternate universe, which lesser known or character actor became a Clooney Pitt level star?
There's a guy right now who's getting a little bit more acclaim these days, but I think he's around the age of Brad Pitt, and it's Coleman Domingo, who plays Ali on Euphoria.
Oh.
It's a Zendaya's sponsor on Euphoria, and especially in the in-between season special episodes that they made, there's a whole thing with him in a diner talking to Zendaya, and it's great. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely great. On the female side, Fairuza Balk came up to my, I think a lot of times people focused on her looking weird and, or whatever, or she just seemed like, I don't know. She's beautiful to me. I love Fairuza Balk, but like, I don't know. They always leaned into her being weird. And I think it was after The Craft, she kind of got that, I don't know, typecast a bit. But I would love to see a universe where Fairuza Balk has a big, huge career. Cause I think she's really good. And I don't think she got the credit she wanted. So
that's a good answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good answer. I like that you'd get a man and a woman, and you were diverse, and I just did a white dude.
Well, you know, it's Clooney Pitt.
I'm going with Kyle Chandler, who, if you watch a lot of movies, you probably know who Kyle Chandler is, partly because he's in every other movie. But he's a great actor, and he's got the looks to be that kind of an A-list star.
It's kind of insane that he's not bigger. Like, it, I've always thought this. Like, there's a reason why he's in a million movies. Because, you know, but he's, he, I don't know. Is it too late for him to become like the big star or whatever? Like, people, I don't know.
I mean,
how does that work?
Some of this may be, you know, their choices. Maybe he would rather be the guy who's in Argo and, you know, not playing the Ben Affleck role. I don't know. I just think he's got the chops and the looks. He could have gone to the top, I tell you. Mm-hmm. Let's see what some other people say. Judy Greer.
Greer is a great one. Oh, my God.
Excellent answer. William Fichtner.
Sam Neill. I will say Sam Neill definitely has become, I mean, he's not a Clooney Pitt, but he definitely has a huge career. There was one on here I saw that I thought, oh, Garrett Dillahunt. Yeah, for sure. He's got that great moment in No Country for Old Men that you love. Where he's, oh my God, Jared.
Whoa, differences.
That's what it is. And he shows up in Ambulance, giving that movie its very few positives every once in a while. But yeah, Garrett Dillahunt would be great. Pedro Pascal. Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
Oscar Isaac is mentioned, although I think Oscar Isaac has definitely gotten to that point where I don't know if anybody gets that kind of career anymore, though, right? Does anybody get a Clooney Pitt career anymore,
even
as good as they are? DiCaprio, type of thing?
DiCaprio would have that if he would make more movies. He makes a movie every 3 or 4 years, and I think he's the same level of A-list, but he's not going to... There's a reason that the question had Clooney and Pitt and not Clooney and DiCaprio. Like, Clooney and Pitt both work a bunch, are handsome as fuck, get paid more than anybody else, get a lot of awards nominations, produce like crazy. You know, I love Leo, but he makes a movie and then he goes on a yacht for 3 years. I think Oscar Isaac is at an A-list level, but Clooney
he's gotten
and
that
Pitt,
point.
Like, A plus.
He's definitely gotten to that point. I just don't know if we're ever gonna, you know, what I'm getting at is I don't know if we'll ever get to a point where somebody's name sells the movie as much. And it's never been someone's name just straight up sells a movie. It's sure. always got to be the name with a movie that looks good. It can't be, you know, you can ask DiCaprio about how J. Edgar came out. You know, I mean, that didn't do well. I mean, and Pitt and Clooney obviously have a lot of movies that did not hit very well.
Yeah.
When you get to this point where they're always in every single movie that you want to watch, you know, that's something that we're not going to see. I don't know if we'll ever see that again, the way everything is so fragmented these days.
And
somebody, Patrick, mentioned Summer Glau. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Summer Glau. Anyway, that's going to do for Wreckatopia episode 12.
Yeah.
Thank you guys in chat for coming out and giving us your comments and everything. We love you guys. Locke is next week.
Yep. We'll see you guys.
See you guys. Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Chick, 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 chick. I remember I hyped up hockey to this guy I knew for like months, and finally he agreed to go to a game with me, and it was literally one of those 1-in-30 most boring games ever.
Oh, yeah.
Where nothing happens, there's no fighting, there's nothing exciting, the crowd is dead, and I don't think he's ever been to another game since, and I don't blame him. The names are up. All these people who were just in Nashville are like, these food recommendations are a week too late.
I'm going to be calling somebody out that's going to hear these outtakes, and they're going to be like, hey, I didn't mean it that way. Part of the group, part of the people who came out said, well, I was doing this and this and this today. And he goes, well, I think I maybe should have asked you this question then. And I was like, all right. Are you ready to laugh?